Blog Talk Radio.
To the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Thanks for listening this evening and the EAL radio show, where we come to you each Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our regular hosts are Steve Thompson, Margaret Bars, Chuck Albright, Howard Mucci, Jim Graybill, George Jen, Neil Holland, and this is Neil Holland speaking. Jim Hart is our normal introduction host, but he's unable to be with us tonight, along with Margaret. We'll be here. I believe George is, has a birthday for his oldest daughter, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that. But let's introduce our host for this evening that are with us. And Margaret is out of the office right now. Hopefully she'll be back with us before we go off air. And so I can tell you now, in Jacksonville, Florida, Ponte Vedra, which is a suburb of Jacksonville, it's been very nice here the last couple of days. A little bit warm, but we get a sprinkle or two, and it cools it off in the evening. So can't complain about that. And also with us here in Jacksonville is Herb Godfrey, who comes on when I ask him to. He is so generous with filling in and telling us a little bit about the Delta connection, which we call the Delta connection. Just a minute, Jim. Well, I should have said just a minute to Herb. Herb, are you with us?
I am. I'm here, Neil, and thanks for that nice introduction.
Well, we have a surprise for you later on in the show. See if you can recognize it, okay?
Okay.
And also, we have Steve Hart. I'm getting Jim Hart's name mixed with yours, Steve Thompson. But you're up there in the beautiful hills of North Carolina. How are things in Roaring Gap?
Yeah, that's okay, Neil. I've been called a lot of things, so that doesn't bother me a bit. Roaring Gap has been roaring with rain for the past 4 or 5 days. All of our streams are run overflowing, but the temperature has been a beautiful high 60s, and current temperature right now is 72 degrees. And I just spent a beautiful weekend with over 100 family members to attend a family reunion, coupled with my oldest granddaughter's wedding. And I don't believe I'm old enough to have a granddaughter getting married, but that happened.
Very good, Steve. It tells you something, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Everything creaks and squeaks and aches and whatever. But
yes.
We've got Chuck in the central part of Florida, down by the Ocala area and little town. It's not little anymore, is it, Chuck? It's called the Villages of Florida. How are you, Chuck?
I'm real good tonight. And no, we're growing. We just passed 110,000 people, and we're pushing close to 50,000 homes pretty soon. We've had similar weather than throughout the week, but today it changed drastically for us. We were supposed to have a high of 90 and a low of 72 tonight, But unfortunately, the thunderstorms came running through, and now we're sitting somewhere around about 84 degrees up until about 7 p.m., and then, of course, the humidity is going to drop to about 67%, which means it looks like we're going to get early thunderstorms tonight. But hopefully they'll clear out tomorrow because the golf courses are ready, and we just finished our 51st golf course here. Neil?
That's hard to believe, 100,000 people. Now, you're including Ocala and Gainesville in that count, aren't you, for the villages?
No. The villages sits on 25,000 acres, and that actually it's 110,000 people we just passed this month. And it's only the village people. It doesn't include Leesburg or Ocala. We are the largest retirement center in the world.
Sounds like a town of that strategic location right in the center of Florida. You're not too far from Orlando, just north of Orlando and south of Ocala, I guess.
Orlando is about 70 miles south, and Ocala is about 27 miles north. We sit about approximately in the middle of the state. It's 100 miles towards each body of water. If you want to travel over there and go to the beach and go to the ocean, have a good swimmer.
Well, we also have a host with us from the Bluegrass State. Is it still called the Bluegrass State, Jim Grable?
Oh, yeah, Neil. It's Bluegrass. And really, if you have a good sunshiny day, you look out across some of the greens here, it's grass really does look blue. It's been kind of rainy and stormy the last couple of days here. We've had an awful lot of water, so I suspect we're going to have some flooding around in the low-lying areas. But it's a beautiful state.
Yeah, uh-oh. That rain's going to turn that green grass bluer, I guess, huh?
It sure is. The people here that are cutting grass there... They're in high gear right now.
Yeah.
Jim, I have a question. This is Steve.
Steve.
Bluegrass state, is it also not known as the state for beautiful horses and fast women, or is it the other way around?
Either way you want to take that one, Steve.
Fast.
But the answer to your question is yes.
There you go.
Well, let's see. We've got a caller on area code 603. Caller, can you identify yourself?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Who is this?
This is Kenny O'Connor. I recognize Steve Thompson, former Charlotte pilot. Finally got around to reading the Eastern News here, and glad to hear the voices from the old times, you might say.
Now, once again, give us your name. And, Steve, do you know this gentleman?
Can you give us your name again?
I'm Kenny O'Connor. I'm Charlotte pilot. I believe he's one of those senior people down there at the time.
Kenny, I'm sorry. I don't remember, but the name is familiar.
I'm not surprised. I was Convair co-pilot at the time.
Convair co-pilot. Oh, boy, that brings back memories. That's where I started, in the right seat of the Convair.
Well,
it's a good place to start, guys.
Went on from there to second officer on the Electra in New York and moved along the line, became 727 and A300 captain.
Okay. When did you retire, Kenny?
At the end, when things didn't go too good, I walked the line, and that was my choice.
Okay, well, that's all that we have with us as far as on the board here. So with that, I'm going to say, folks, remember, if you want to call in to the show, our phone number is area code 213-816-1611. That's 213-816-1611. And by golly, I hear an echo, so perhaps that echo helps when I give out the phone number. But be sure to press number 1 on your phone keypad when you call in, and that'll put you on the queue here, and we'll be able to see your number and open it up so you can say whatever you need to say. Tonight our show is about a little bit along the lines of last week's show, which was really a show about nothing. And so our show tonight is titled Inconsequential Facts. Inconsequential Facts, which is really another show about nothing. But before we get into this irrelevant material that we hope to present in a fashion that might be of interest to you, I want to play a special sound clip for Herb Godfrey and see if he can identify the airline that is played in this TV commercial.
Look at our route map, and what do you see? Clean lines connecting city to city. The map shows you where we go, but not how we get there. Because in this business, there are no straight lines, only the twists and turns of an unpredictable industry. The passengers change, the gates change, government regulations change, oil peaks and plummets, and let's not even get started on the weather. The fact is, no two flights are ever the same, no matter how many times we've accomplished them in the past. The 80,000 employees at Delta must predict the unpredictable, anticipate the unexpected, and never let the rules overrule common sense. This is how we tame the unwieldiness of air travel, pull it taut, and wrap it around the globe until it's not just lines you see. It's the world.
I love Sutherland's voice. I think Delta did the right thing in selecting Sutherland as their spokesperson. And Herb, what do you think about that?
Well, I was just surprised that he didn't use the expression Brand X, you know?
No, that was reserved for Eastern people only.
I see. Yeah, that was a great commercial, and I have a good friend of mine said, boy, Delta must really be trying to save some money because now their commercials are in black and white.
There you go. But they do have some great commercials, and they are very interesting, entertaining, so you listen all the way through. And so I think Delta has come a long way in improving their commercials from the past, and I wish we could hear Eastern commercials in the future. We're hoping to hear some coming up maybe next year, hopefully. But as I mentioned, our show tonight is entitled Inconsequential Facts, and it's part 2 of last week's show about nothing. And I'll start the show by using some of the most inconsequential facts about airlines and aviation, and see if you guys can give me an answer to these points of aviation trivia. First of all, let's see if we can get to a real basic one. The first solo flight across the Atlantic Ocean was performed by whom? Anyone like to take that one?
Oh, boy.
That's a toughie.
First, how come it's dead silence here, Neil?
Come on, anyone?
Well, we know it isn't Lindbergh.
Well, I thought it was.
No, it's not. It was a French guy. It came the other way.
Across the Atlantic Ocean was not by Lindbergh?
Not the first one. He did it, but I don't think he was the first one.
I thought he was.
I'm
going to have to look that one up.
That's why I think that's why he's so famous, Charles Lindbergh, flying the Spirit of St. Louis across the Atlantic Ocean. Or was it the Pacific Ocean?
Well, if
he
was
across the Atlantic Ocean by himself.
Well,
he was
that's solo, I believe, by
solo
yourself.
Flight.
Well,
I think the French guy had a navigator or a co-pilot with him.
Well,
a couple of the French guys crashed and burned, didn't they, on their trying to beat Lindbergh?
Yeah, yeah. And Lindbergh did have a passenger, if you guys saw The Spirit of St. Louis with Jimmy Stewart playing Charles Lindbergh. Do you remember who the passenger was he had with him?
Cut me on that one. I've always seen him explain himself. A dog?
He had a fly, F-L-Y.
No kidding.
With little, small, teeny, tiny wings.
Oh, my goodness.
You
did that help him up?
Helped him fly the airplane. I think it was the fly.
They're running out of gas. Flapping in wings.
Yeah. And along with that, which aircraft was used on the first cross-country Atlantic solo flight? What was the name of that airplane? Of course, we just said it was the Spirit of St. Louis.
Spirit of St. Louis, wasn't it?
Yeah. One interesting thing was what was the first airline? Which airline claims to be the first airline in the world?
Whoa, let's see. I remember reading that somewhere. Where did I read that at? DeLag.
Wasn't it Pan Am?
It was KLM. KLM. KLM claims to be the first airline in the world. And there is a claim with Tony Janus down in Tampa when they had the airboat, the flying boat across Tampa Bay. And it became a scheduled service for a few flights until I think it operated about a year. Yeah, and they say they are the oldest airline in the world. Now, which is the only airplane so far that was supersonic?
Airline. Concorde.
Okay. The Concorde. Okay, very good. Well. I see you guys are really sharp on the answers here. And so let's see if I can find a little bit harder. Which airport would you think would be the world's busiest airport?
Let's see here.
I would say Hartsfield Airport.
Okay, I don't have the correct sound, but you are correct. And can you tell me what ORD stands for? As far as the airport identifier?
O'Hare Airport.
Okay.
No.
But it's O'Hare, but what does ORD stand for?
It's Orchard.
Orchard Field, that's correct. Orchard Field. And can you tell me when was hijacking of airplanes officially outlawed? Believe it or not, before this date, you could actually hijack an airplane, and there was no law against it.
I'm going to guess 1972.
Right, bingo, 1972. This is an interesting one here. How much do you think American Airlines spends on in-flight meals?
Take a guess here.
$150 million, right on the money. Boy, how did you come up with that answer? That's great. That's super.
You want me to tell you how I come up with the right answer?
No, tell me.
It's on page 6.
All right. Well, how high does a Boeing 747 usually fly?
Oh. You trailed off there. I didn't hear that.
Can an airliner fly higher than 41,000 feet?
Let somebody.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They can, actually.
They can?
I've done it.
Yeah,
I've done
can.
That, yeah.
K- Can you tell me what's the limiting factor as far as the altitude commercial airliners fly?
Well, basically, I think it's type of plane, weight, some of the other stuff.
Weight and temperature, isn't it?
Yeah.
No.
Temperature of the day.
Well, that has something to do with it. Let's just say that temperature and weight doesn't really have anything to do with it, and the airplane is empty and flown by like a drone. What do you think would be the restrictive altitude of most air? What governs the altitude limitations of an airplane?
Air density.
Air density? Yeah, I guess when you run out of air, you run out of air, and it won't go any further.
Out of air, yeah.
But you remember all the Boeings were put into a tank, a water tank, and they were pressurized, and they have to meet the pressurization, and they are limited to the structural integrity of the airplane. And I believe the 757 structurally, you remember the 727, I think, was 41,000 feet structurally. And the 757, I believe, was 43,000. But at any rate, well, that's all the trivia and inconsequential information that I have. Steve, do you have anything that you'd like to add to that? Or
yes,
your own
I do.
Inconsequential facts?
I have some, and with or without the information I'm going to give you, that your lives will not change 1 second. But at any rate, it is, just bear with me, and it has to do with in-flight medical emergencies. And it happens on about 1 in 600 flights. An onboard medical emergency requires help and sometimes an unscheduled landing. Passengers are often left wondering what happened. Now, Melinda Beck reveals the numbers behind the in-flight medical emergencies, including types of illnesses, who treats sick passengers while mid-flight, and methods of treatment. A new study in the New England Journal of Medicine opens a window into some 12,000 in-flight medical emergencies on 5 airlines over a 3-year period. Dramatic or serious incidents, pregnancy complications, psychiatric episodes, cardiac arrest were relatively rare, the researchers found. The most common problems, fainting, followed by difficulty breathing, gastrointestinal problems, and cardiac symptoms. The researchers concluded that most in-flight medical emergencies are evaluated and treated effectively. Passengers who are physicians provided help in nearly half the cases, and nurses helped in 20%, emergency medical technicians in 4%. From a medical emergency standpoint, flying commercial aircraft is generally very safe. Most emergencies can be handled with simple intervention, and there are many health care providers on board and answer a call to provide assistance, said Christina Martin Gill, one of the study's authors. He helped staff the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine Center that provides 24-hour consultations for in-flight emergencies for the airlines studied, and that fields an average of 1 call per hour. Overall, agitation or psychiatric symptoms made up 2% of in-flight medical emergencies, according to the analysts from UPSM. Obstetrical symptoms accounted for just 0.5% of emergencies, but for 18% of flight diversions. Most occurred in women who were less than 24 weeks pregnant and had signs of possible miscarriage. Pilots diverted to make unscheduled landings in about 70% of the cases, most often because of cardiac arrest. About 26% of passengers with in-flight emergencies were transported to a hospital on landing, 9% were admitted, and 0.3%, or just 36 passengers, died, again, mostly from cardiac arrest. Automated external defibrillators were applied to 137 patients, but usually inappropriately, the researchers found. Only 24 passengers were in cardiac arrest, and the AEDs, which evaluate the patient's condition, delivered shocks to just 5. The researchers did note that many of the cases of lightheadedness can be due to relatively low oxygen content of cabin air, roughly equal to 8,000 feet above sea level, or passengers experiencing dehydration during long or multiple flights. Most sufferers felt better with oxygen, rest, and fluids, and did not require a flight diversion, they wrote. The authors also noted that having anti-nausea medication on board reduced the need to divert flights due to severe nausea or vomiting. Now, a Federal Aviation Administration spokeswoman said in an email the agency would review the study. The U.S. airlines carry a robust medical kit for emergencies, she said. However, the FAA's goal is to get a sick passenger to appropriate medical care on the ground. Now, there's even more useful equipment may be coming. When fellow passengers reported chest pains on 2 recent flights, cardiologist Eric Topol was able to check their heart rhythms with an electrocardiogram app on his iPhone called AliveCore. In one case, he was able to reassure a passenger she was not in danger, and the flight continued. In another, the EKG detected a heart attack. The pilot landed in minutes, and when the ambulance was standing by. Now, while waiting to take off, the device became a conversation piece, recalls Dr. Popel, who is director of the Scripps Translational Science Institute. All flight attendants wanted to have their electrocardiograms done also. So that's Steve's inconsequential facts. Do you all have some comments on this?
Yes, I do, Steve, before anyone else jumps in. I had a flight from Miami to New York, and offshore, a beam, Charleston, South Carolina, out on the old, what we call the Control 1150, direct to New York. I had the flight attendant come up and ask me to make an announcement to see if there was a physician on board or a doctor on board the airplane. This was at night. This was a night flight. And full house, we had the airplane completely filled. We were at about 35,000 feet, somewhere around there. And so I did make the announcement, and there was a female doctor, and she was a baby doctor. And I forgot what they call the baby doctors, OBGYN or pediatrics or whatever it was. But she went and looked at the person in next to the last seat in the stretched Boeing 727 aircraft. And it was her opinion that he needed to get on the ground as soon as possible. So we made a call to center and asked to make an immediate left turn and head for Charleston, South Carolina. And we were on the ground in 15 minutes from the time that we started our descent. And we were on the ground, and the emergency vehicles were waiting for the airplane and the passenger, and they came in, and they had to stabilize him for about 10 minutes before they removed him off the airplane. He was still alive. He was in his 80s. He was accompanied by his wife. They were being served dinner, and his wife was in shock, and at any rate, they removed him off the airplane. And wouldn't you know, while we were at the airport there in Charleston waiting to take off again back to on our course to New York, that a New York passenger was complaining the whole time to the flight attendants, didn't see why we had to make a stop in Charleston for someone. But as I found out later, I got a letter from, at that time, the president of Eastern Airlines, Frank Borman thanking me for doing what I did, and also the executive vice president, I forgot his name, of Eastern, one of the executive vice presidents of Eastern Airlines, because it was his father who was traveling on a pass. He was in his 80s, and en route from the airport to the hospital for whatever they could do for him, he passed away. And that was my experience with someone that had to be on the ground immediately. So it does happen, and I guess that was it was a cardiac arrest, of course.
Can you say what you have to program into your cell phone to get that EKG program? What's it called?
It is called AliveCor, A-L-I-V-E-C-O-R.
C-O-R, Alive.
Good information, Steve. Very good information.
Mm-hmm. Thank
Chuck,
you.
Chuck, you have something about bumblebees or something like that you wanted to tell us about?
Yes, I do. It's, bumblebee argument, as stated, says bumblebees can't fly. The origin of the statement is lost in the midst of time. But one version says it was made by a French entomologist named Auguste Magnum in 1934, based on a calculation by his assistant, an engineer. The bumblebee argument in pseudoscience states that the law of aerodynamics proved that bumblebees can't fly, as it does not have the required capacity in terms of wing area or flapping speed. Consequently, therefore, science can be shown to be an error, proving a light a loophole for the pseudoscience's explanation. Arguments like these are occasionally used by creationists to claim that it's impossible for bees to be the product of evolution, though they're quite common and more general in any science circles that like to cry, "Look at science, it knows nothing." Unfortunately for the pseudoscientists, the laws of physics do not in any way forbid bumblebee flight. There's no paper that denies bumblebee flight. There's no scientist that has done so in a lecture, except perhaps, ironically. To put it simply, it's impossible to prove that a bumblebee can't fly if you perform an extremely crude calculation, like forgetting to take into account that the rate of flapping, the rotation of the wing, the action of vortex. The other suggests that the bumblebee can't fly according to the principles of fixed wings dynamics. Now, all you pilots perk up here. That is to say, it must flap its wings. In fact, bumblebees simply flap harder than other insects, increasing the amplitude of their wing strokes to achieve more lift and to use a figure eight wing motion to create low pressure vortexes to pull them up. But full flapping, the rotation of the wings, or the action of vortexes, the full aerodynamic calculations, to say nothing of getting all empirical and watching a bumblebee fly, will show that bumblebee flight works perfectly fine. In 2009, Mike Huckabee, while campaigning for presidential nomination, the depth of his scientific knowledge, he said, is scientifically impossible for a bumblebee to fly. But the bumblebee, being unaware of science facts, flies anyway. So there it is. That's the truth. Any questions on that?
Yeah, I've never seen a bumblebee fly, so it must be accurate.
Well, you're just going to have to pay attention to them little critters, because sometimes they land and they're not very happy about it.
You know, their wing area ratio to the fuselage of a bumblebee is way out of proportion, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the, one of the things I said, that in terms of wing area or flapping speed, that's why the people say it can't fly, because obviously they... the wings aerodynamically are not capable of, if you put it on a some kind of a drawing plan, it says, oh, yeah, that's gonna work. It's not going to work, according to if you put it on paper. But they do fly, and they do quite well.
Speaking of things other than airplanes that fly, I think one of the most interesting thing is a hummingbird. Some of the facts that go along with their speed and their direction of flight and the distance that they commute back and forth to this country is just really fascinating.
I think I read something about it. It's one of the few birds that actually can turn 90 degrees, straight 90 degrees, because of the way they do flap their wings.
Right.
That was the forerunner of the Harrier aircraft, wasn't it?
The Hurry.
Herb,
no, that's good. I like that.
Herb Godfrey?
No, the only thing, I've got some trivia, and I think you'll appreciate this. Delta Airlines, ever since its inception, was decided that when they began their service that the airline was three separate words, Delta Airlines. And that's a little-known fact, but I know you would appreciate it.
Well, guess what? Eastern Airlines at one time were three separate words, Eastern Airlines. And that was changed. Does anyone remember the date it was changed and whose administration it was?
I think it was Floyd Hall.
I believe you're right. Floyd Hall changed it, and it was one word, Eastern, and the one word was airlines. A lot of the purists, and probably like Delta, still go by the three-word name, Delta Airlines, I'm sure, like Eastern Airlines. We've got some people that, when they write anything usually appears in one of the magazines or newspapers, Eastern newspapers or magazines, it does carry the three-name designation. But that before, Eastern Airlines was Eastern Air Transport, and then they dropped the transport, Rickenbacker, when he took over, and it was called Eastern Airlines. So Delta Airlines, now, you had your origin, I believe, Herb, wasn't it somewhere in the Mississippi Delta?
Monroe, Louisiana.
That was the founding headquarters of Delta?
That's correct.
And had it always been called Delta? It was crop dusting, wasn't it, in Louisiana?
That's how they'd be crop dusting and carrying mail for the federal government, and went on from there.
Okay. And the famous president that was a founder for many, many years was, what was his name? Mr. Woolman.
That's right.
Was he a pilot also?
No, he was not. He went by C.E. Woolman. That was his name. And he was not a pilot, but he got along well with the pilots, though, quite well.
C.E. Woolman, that's right. Okay, very good. And the other person I think it was United Airlines, also went by his initial, and that was, American Airlines, C.R. Smith. You recall C.R. Smith? He went by C.R. Smith. And I think he was a founder of United. Interesting, very interesting, Herb. Jim Graybill, do you have something that you want to contribute as far as nothing
Let's
is concerned or inconsequential facts?
Let's get a little bit more inconsequential, about the Bluegrass Airport here in Lexington. There were three airlines, and two of the three had a race the day that the airport opened for airline travel. Anybody have any idea who that was? Or who the three airlines were?
Wow. Well,
got me.
Give me a hint. What year was it?
Right after World War II.
Well, the Ludington wasn't associated with Kentucky, was it?
No. Eastern and Delta and
American, probably.
No, Piedmont.
Piedmont, okay, all right. That makes sense.
And Eastern and Delta had a big hoorah about which one was the first one to come in here.
Okay, which was the first, do you remember?
Well, we still think it was Eastern Airlines.
Yeah, Herb would say Delta, of course.
Without a doubt, Neil.
Okay, without a doubt. Well, we're hoping to get a fellow named Don Witt to be on one of our future shows. Don wrote a very interesting article in the EARA newspaper, and it had to do with the closing of the old Atlanta terminal. And he wrote a great article about the transition of the Eastern personnel and equipment and all of that over to the new terminal. But what was so interesting about his story was that the new terminal was to open at 4 a.m. in the morning. And, of course, Eastern had a flight scheduled in at 4:35 a.m. And Delta Airlines, got the type of equipment, DC-8, I believe, landed a little bit after midnight. And so Delta had intentions of becoming the first airline to occupy the new midfield terminal. And, of course, Eastern knew that it was going to be first because of the time that their first arrival was to arrive at the airport. It was a DC-9. And so, anyhow, that story is really fascinating as to who actually won, Delta or Eastern. You guys have any guesses?
I don't know. If he was there at 12 o'clock, he must have been there at 4 o'clock.
The terminal opened at 4 o'clock a.m. Delta arrived a little bit after midnight, and Delta parked away from the terminal, awaiting to arrive at the gate at 4 a.m. to open the new midfield terminal. However, other things happened, and you'll have to listen in to Don Witt's answer to that question. Okay.
I think I have shared with you once before about a competition of arrivals, first arrivals. I flew with a fellow by the name of Bob Ashcraft in Charlotte, and in a Martin 404. And we had a flight that came through Augusta, going to Columbia, and then on to Charlotte. And at the same time that there was a Delta flight that departed within minutes of our scheduled depart within minutes of our flight, and there would be occasions where one of the other carriers would be a little bit late, and it was not unusual at all for the one who departed first, if the other carrier was not very close behind, that they would circle the Augusta airport until the other carrier got off the ground, and then the race was on into Columbia. And I can tell you it was probably in some cases quite dangerous, not really, but it certainly did not fit in with the various requirements of separation, and it got to the fact where it was at the Columbia controllers would just say, "Okay, you're both cleared to land, and best man wins." That was a fun time.
That would have been a lot of fun.
Hey Herb, here's a question.
I used to fly with Bob Ashcraft out of Charlotte.
Yeah, I can believe that story.
Well, here's a question for Herb Godfrey. Did you guys, as station managers, did you have any problems with crazy, activities like Steve just described between Delta and Eastern? Did you have any reports from the pilots or any of the people as far as the competition? Because it was fierce back in the 70s and 80s.
Oh, without a doubt. Not so much from the flight group, but the customer service group. When I was down in Orlando, the Naval Training Center was operating at that time, and they used to bring out busloads of recruits that had just graduated, and they would all be ticketed according to the SATO offices and so on and so forth. But both carriers, in fact, Delta, Eastern, National, and Southern at the time, have representatives out in the lobby. And when these recruits would come in and they'd ask, where is so-and-so, they would point them to their respective carriers, disregarding the fact whatever their tickets read at the time. And it was fierce. I mean, it was fierce competition. In fact, it got to the point where the carriers, those four carriers, would entice the bus drivers to drop off at points on the curb so they'd be closer to their counters. So fierce competition. And I'm sure the flight group was the very same.
Yeah, it really was. Well, guys, go ahead.
Herb, this is Steve. In a previous broadcast, we had we were graced with your presence, and we had a conversation about a station manager in Orlando who was at one time the station manager of Asheville, and that name I have forgotten, and I don't know, I should not have, because he was the station manager in Asheville when I was learning to fly there. Can you remind me of that name again?
I'm thinking you're referring to, and his last name's escaping me right now, but his first name was Charlie.
No, that
wasn't it.
He was a redheaded guy, as I remember.
No, I'm thinking, and unfortunately, again, I can't think of his name, but the gentleman I'm speaking about, he was there from probably early 70s up until the late 80s. In fact, he assisted with when Eastern filed for bankruptcy. He went up to Atlanta and helped the bankruptcy operation. But I'm sorry, his name escapes me right at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah, I just remember him so well because he was there when I was learning to fly, and I remember everything about him except his name.
Well, guys, guess who just walked in? Margaret. Now, when she puts her headset on and brings the microphone up to her, beautiful, let's stop right there. I'm going to let her say the rest of the story. I've saved the last, the best for last. That's what it should last for best. The best for last. Margaret, what say you?
Well, you call that irrelevant? Here's something really big in the inconsequential facts category, but that is very relevant and something that we cannot live without. So I'd like to talk about the phenomenon of zero. Zero, zip, zilch, nada. How often has a question been answered by one of these words? Countless, no doubt. Yet behind this seemingly simple answer, conveying nothing, lays the story of an idea that took many centuries to develop, many countries to cross, and many minds to comprehend. Understanding and working with zero is the basis of our world today. Without zero, we would lack calculus, financial accounting, the ability to make arithmetic computations quickly, and especially in today's connected world, computers. The story of zero is the story of an idea that has aroused the imagination of great minds across the globe. When anyone thinks of 100, 200, or 7,000, the image in his or her mind is of a digit followed by a few zeros. The zero functions as a placeholder. That is, three zeros denotes that there are 7,000s rather than only 700s. If we were missing 10, that would drastically change the amount. So just imagine having 10 erased or added to your salary. Yet the number system we use today, Arabic, though it in fact came originally from India, is relatively new. For centuries, people marked quantities with a variety of symbols and figures, although it was awkward to perform the simplest arithmetic calculations with these number systems. So to just give you a brief history of zero, it was the Sumerians who were the first to develop a counting system to keep an account of their stock of goods, cattle, horses, and donkeys, for example. The Sumerian system was positional, that is, the placement of a particular symbol relative to the others denoted its value. And the Sumerian system was handed down to the Akkadians around 2500 BC and then to the Babylonians in 2000 BC. It was, in fact, the Babylonians who first conceived of a mark to signify that a number was absent from the column. But it would still be centuries before the symbol as we know it today appeared. Now, many renowned mathematicians among the ancient Greeks who learned the fundamentals of their math from the Egyptians did not have a name for zero. Now, they may have pondered it, but there's no conclusive evidence to say the symbol even existed in their language. It was, in fact, the Indians who began to understand zero both as a symbol and an idea. And around 650 AD, the Indians were the first to formalize arithmetic operations using zero. But it would still be a few centuries before zero reached Europe. And first, the great Arabian voyagers would bring many of the texts back and from India, along with spices and other exotic items. And then zero reached Baghdad by 773 AD. Now, fast forwarding, thanks to the conquest of Spain by the Moors, zero finally reached Europe by the middle of the 12th century. But there was an Italian mathematician, Fibonacci, who built his work with algorithms, and he did that in 1202. And until that time, the abacus had been the most prevalent tool to perform arithmetic operations. And still fast-forwarding, finally, in the 1600s, Newton and a colleague solved this the problem of the zero independently and opened the world to tremendous possibilities. So by working with numbers as they approach zero, calculus was born, without which we wouldn't have physics, engineering, and many aspects of economics and finance. And today, in the 21st century, zero is so familiar that to talk about it seems like much ado about nothing. But it is precisely understanding and working with this nothing that has allowed civilization to progress. The development of zero across continents, centuries, and minds has made it one of the greatest accomplishments of human society. Because math is a global language and calculus its crowning achievement, zero exists and it is used everywhere. But like its function as a symbol and a concept meant to denote absence, zero may still seem like nothing at all. Yet recall the fears over Y2K, and zero no longer seems like a tale told by an idiot.
Very good.
You didn't have to find that out at UK, did you? It sounds like my bank account anyway.
Marvin just got up and went home.
A footnote to zero.
A
footnote to zero. Do you know that the first computers were based on binary numbers of 1 and 0?
Yeah. Well, I think there would be no 007. Oh, by the way, that reminds me, why is zero sometimes called O, like my phone number
aught,
is 260 and aught, a double aught, double aught?
Well,
that's not something I programmed in my computer.
Well, it's inconsequential, whatever the answer is, I'm sure. Jim Hart, are you with us tonight?
Yes, I am, Neil. I'm sorry to be late. Listen, about double aught, anyone who does any deer hunting knows what a double aught buckshot is.
Yes, they do.
Is it two BBs in it, two zeros or whatever?
It's very painful.
Jim, you got on board just about the time we were about ready to close out our session tonight. And I have a few announcements that we'll wait, and they can wait until next week because we're just about out of time. But it's been fun having talked about nothing last show and inconsequential facts this show. So we couldn't get any, I don't think, worse for subjects to talk about in the future.
Did anyone give the definition of irrelevant?
No, what is it?
Actually, it's illogical, irrelevant, of no significance, unimportant, and it's usually used as an adjective.
Okay. All right. Well, that really defines tonight's show.
I wonder if that's another way of using the word zero.
Nothing. Yeah.
Rolling.
We did discover how flights were numbered last show, and that was very interesting. And Bill Joseph emailed me, and he said, you know, we were talking about flight numbers, Herb, about how they determine flight numbers, and from one, you know, departure to the destination, and then usually coming back, it's the even or odd numbers, or going east or west, it's even or odd. But he said, believe it or not, Delta Airlines had a flight number 1852 en route from Atlanta to West Palm Beach, PBI. It was flight 852, scheduled from a turn aircraft from West Palm Beach to Atlanta, per flightware.com, he said, and it had the same number both north and southbound, and it operated as 1852 in both directions. That's quite unusual.
Yes, and also, just also to add to that, all the major carriers also had numbers that were filed with the FAA. Delta was 006. And Eastern, I think, was 008.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, all the major carriers had designated numbers for their carriers.
Oh, these were when they appeared on the FAA records. It was they were assigned a number each carrier.
That's correct. And also all the passenger ticket stock began with the airline's identification number 006.
Okay.
So
that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Jim Hart, would you carry us out for tonight?
I will. Well, Eastern family, that's our show about inconsequential facts, which really was something about nothing. Please tell your friends and anyone you know that remember Eastern Airlines about our show, the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Remember, you can listen to us anytime around the clock by going to our archive of over 118 broadcasts. Just type in on your computer www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. I hear the champagne music of Lawrence Welk. So for this week, we wish you and yours a week filled with more than nothing. Keep the blue side up, safe air speed, and plenty of altitude. Good night, Eastern family.
Good
night,
Eastern
family.
And Delta.